from the syllabus. And just to keep you up to date here, it looks like the laboratory assignment for this week is helium. And to begin, if you can, looking at general basic types of connections. But toward the end of the lab, you should be able to start looking at collagen fibers and fibroblasts and connective tissue. So the schedule is tentative, and so it isn't necessarily true that you have to reach a certain point that the syllabus has to you. Goal today is to finish up with cell histology. What I was trying to say was that we're going to finish up with cell histology today. Hopefully, finish up. But doesn't really matter if we don't end up with helium. I do need once again, to introduce some of the things you're going to see in the lab. Either last 20 minutes, we'll look at connective tissue. To start with. We left off the last time talking about some cell organelles in the office. Toward the end of the session last time, we talked about some cell organelles, cell structure that is not composed of membrane. And the plasmic reticulum is membrane, mitochondria contain membrane. Most of the things, including the nucleus, has membranes associated. There are things like the cytoskeleton, little threads and filaments that act like a skeleton, maintain form for the cell, and also to move things around. And we said that microtubules are a great example of a cytoskeleton. They're in specialized structures of the epithelium, like the flagellum. Microvilli. What determines the identity of a flagellum, you think? What structure provides the locomotion? Microtubule. 9+2 arrangement of microtubules. Flagellum. So what is a flagellum then? Cilium. Flagella are cilia. The tail of the sperm. Flagellum on certain microorganisms. They are cilia. Have this 9+2 microtubule arrangement. You don't have a bar body, raise your hand. Catch anybody. Bar body. Activated X chromosome. What gender contains bar body? Female. So are there any females raising their hands? Are there any males that didn't? Okay, well, I don't have my outline here, but I guess what we're going to talk about, let me borrow your outline. I know what we're going to talk about. Thank you. Give it back to you. Chromosomes? Oh, the cell cycle. Right. And we'll after that. Okay, good. You'll have to clue me in here. Did I lose the... Well, we can describe the life cycle of a cell as the cell cycle. And the cell cycle you'll see in those illustrations, a couple of them in your textbook, look a little bit like the face of a clock. There's a period during the life of the cell that may be 20 minutes or more, from this point to this point, and it's called the M period, or M phase of the cell cycle. And not all cells are engaged in this period of time. And did anyone know what M stands for? Mitosis, period that utilizes famous steps, mitosis. What did you have to do, Brian? Okay. So what are those famous phases of mitosis? Study them until you puked in biology. Prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. So you probably should review what's going on a little bit there. The cell is dividing, isn't it? And so at the end of prophase, we probably have, I mean, at the end of the M phase, we probably now have two cells. Daughter cells are called. I don't know why they're called, not called son cells. I like that better. Called daughter cells. One of these cells may go off and out of the cell cycle and become a contributor to society. May become differentiated, may become specialized and matured to accomplish a particular function that allows us to survive. Like it may become an epithelial cell in our skin. Sometimes both cells leave the cell cycle, but in an epithelium, oftentimes one of the daughter cells remains behind and enters a phase called the G1 phase. G stands for gap. The G1 phase of the cell cycle is a period where they are preparing for the next major activity called the S phase. And what does S stand for? The prephase stands for synthesis of something. DNA. The synthesis of DNA. So the amount of DNA is doubling. Why is the amount of DNA doubling during the S phase? Why is that happening? We have enough DNA for two cells, don't we? Because birth here, coming up, cell has to duplicate its amount of DNA. And so in the G1 phase, the cell isn't totally quiet. It's preparing for this DNA synthesis. And then next phase, I haven't got it. Haven't got the timing very good here. It's called the G or gap 2 phase, and it's the time in the cell where the cell is gaining a proper number of centrioles, an adequate amount of microtubules, and it's doing everything in its power to prepare itself for prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. So all the biochemical activity that's going on, the activity that's preparing for the cell to divide. Right. See? So I see a term that we didn't define yet. You might break the cell cycle down into two major time periods. One time period would be the M phase, mitosis. Rest of the life of the cell is said interphase. When the cell is not in prophase, metaphase, anaphase, or telophase, it's described or defined as being interphase. So what does interphase include? It includes G1, S, and time periods. So there's a major transition point between G1 and S, time period. And there are other transitions of equally important, and sometimes they're called checkpoints. And you can describe these checkpoints in a number of ways. You can describe the checkpoints as something that a cell does because the cell is marked. That's not true. Or you can say it's a mechanism that has evolved over millions of years in cells. This G1S interphase and a number of other checkpoints along the way, the clock stops ticking. The cell stops its own internal clock, and it checks the quality of the DNA. Mutations present in the DNA of this cell. Then the cell tells the mitochondrion to regurgitate into the cytosol substance we talked about yesterday that starts with a C in here. So if the DNA has been mutated and the cell has been so severely affected by ultraviolet radiation or some environmental chemical, then the cell is not going to continue on in the cell cycle, but it eventually dies by apoptosis. So here's another type of suicide, isn't it? Generally not, it doesn't suicide bags. So the mitochondria spit out cytochrome C, and that cell self-destructs. And in biochemistry, obviously, and other courses in here, we'll talk about this process in considerable detail, but not right now. We just need to be aware that there are a variety of checkpoints, and transition points where the cell can decide whether it needs living or not, able to. Oh, I forgot one thing. If there is a DNA mutation and it's just minor, the DNA can be repaired and that mutation eliminated. Plenty of evidence for this, and these checkpoints allow for that to happen. The cell can stop what it's doing and the DNA can be repaired, and then on we go again. So this is a fantastic story, isn't it? During mitosis, I would get a chance to see DNA in all its splendor. Because during interphase, chromosomes don't exist. DNA exists. Talking, why isn't it that chromosomes go interphase? Because the DNA hasn't coiled up yet. Chromosome is an anatomical structure. Chromosome may have some chemistry to it, but it's an anatomical structure. And it isn't present until mitosis begins to form during prophase. But the DNA is always there. So chromosomes contain condensed, coiled up DNA, and certain nucleotide sequences, certain numbers of nucleotide sequences form this famous thing called gene. So what do genes do? Chromosomes are made up, or DNA is made up of gene protein. Glycogen, glyceride, do they code fatty acids? Protein, the other stuff. Other stuff is manufactured different organelles. Aneuploid. Lady, what's diploid? What's haploid mean? They're diploid cells. Cells with paired chromosomes. Chromosome number one, you'll find two of them. Chromosome number two, you'll find two of them. So in humans, the diploid number is 46. What's the haploid number in 23? And where do you find those cells that have the haploid number? Gonads. What do you has to do with number of chromosomes? And what do you think the term euploid might mean? About euchromatin. About you this and you that. What does you mean? True or normal? Normal. So euploidy would be translated as normal number of chromosomes.
Good.
What's N? A-N mean? Not or abnormal? No or not? Not normal. N or A. And those prefixes are used consistently and frequently throughout medical sciences. A and N. Aneuploidy usually is a situation where the chromosome count is an abnormal multiple of 23, an abnormal multiple of the haploid number in the human anyway. For example, 47 chromosomes, not 3, not 3 times 23, aneuploid. And the aneuploid numbers, abnormal numbers of chromosomes. How about if a person had 47 chromosomes revealed in some fashion, and how would it be revealed? Well, let's look at that. How might we be able to identify the chromosome count of any individual before the fetus is born? Well, we're going to look at a picture of that here right now, and that photograph in living black and white called karyotype. The question was, if you had an extra chromosome, if you had an extra chromosome, would you have more than the normal number of genes? Would you make more protein? Possibly, yes. But what happens if that DNA was heterochromatin and it doesn't transcribe anything? So there are some diseases where there's too much of a good thing, like Huntington's chorea, and there are other situations where an extra chromosome doesn't seem to translate as extra protein. It all depends, expressed or not expressed. No consistent rule there. Well, let's see. There's the cell cycle, and one of the things that we didn't talk about was that sometimes a cell will leave the cell cycle not go through the GWAS phase, but we'll come out and we'll go out of the cell cycle and become an active member of our society of cells in our body, like a liver cell. There's a massive liver over here, and after the cells are manufactured, many of them will remain for many, many years, not dividing. And these cells are described as being in the G0 phase, described as stable cells. And when they divide in your liver or other organs? They would divide when there's stress placed on the liver. There's hepatitis infection. There's a blood vessel blockage where there's some stress placed on the liver. And there's a signal system that tells our liver cell it better go back in cell cycle, better return. Started. However, there are some cells that never are able to return cell cycle. And they remain for their lifetime doing a job and unable to return to the cell cycle. Now, there aren't quite as many cells in this category as we once thought, but I'll be traditional about it. Most neurons not return to the cell cycle. And in terms of a clinical approach, I say never, argued by scientists. Neurons never return to the cell cycle. Born with the number of neurons that we'll ever have in our lifetime. It's not quite true, apparently, according to new information. Same is true for our heart cells. Might as well establish right now that we're born with every heart cell we'll ever have, cardiac myocyte, and less. Not quite true either, but it's good enough. Yes, but it has nothing to do with increasing the number of neurons. There's no evidence increasing neurons. There may be more synapses and more communication between cells, but no evidence in the human. Well, except in the hippocampus. There may be some increased cells die. So the contractile cells. Maybe the pacemaker cells too. We're not quite sure about that, actually. I guess we'd have to assume that cannot divide. That's why these neurons and these heart cells can contain lots of lipofuscin, the aging pigment, because the cells can't divide and eliminate. These cells over in that category of permanent non-dividing cells are oftentimes by textbook authors called post-mitotic cells. Why would they be called post-mitotic cells? Post means after. After mitosis means permanently mitotic cells. Okay. No, these hours here, well, for a particular cell, that may be true, but it may be 12 hours in the epidermis of the skin, it may be 6 hours in the epithelium of the varies tremendously. Right. Yep. You can pretty much predict how long they're going to spend in each phase of the cell cycle, unless they're exposed to some abnormal environment. There's another. This is the drawing in Ross. Ross is a little more complicated. And Ross has, if you read the textbook, several roadblocks there. I guess various checkpoints. And you can read about them if you want, but the concept is what's important, not the specific details right now. We didn't realize there were so many places where the cell cycle could be halted if some air. What's this photograph called? Karyotype. Why would you call it karyo? Karyo means karyo. Talk about karyo, prokaryo. What's karyo mean? Fifth. Dogs came from the nucleus. You have 46 of them. Why are there two number ones? Why are there two number twos? Why are there two number threes? Why do we have this redundancy? Diploid. Why is our karyotype diploid? Sperm contributed how many? Three. Eight contributed how many? Three. So one came from pop, one came from mom. And they're not identical, are they? There can be different traits, different genes. Sometimes some of those genes are dominant. Sometimes they're not dominant. Is this person here a male or female? What else is wrong with this individual? Diagnosis that you would make if somebody sent this to you would be trisomy 21 with the old Down syndrome. Anyone sure? That's a little bitty one, isn't it? So you can diagnose involving an haploid number of chromosomes by looking at a picture of them. They gain by sticking this really long needle in the belly of a pregnant female and taking some cells out of the amniotic sac. Amniotic fluid is extracted, and you can manipulate the cells that you take out until you reach this point. And various dyes are used, banding patterns. It requires, to see these dark and light bands requires special staining of a number of different stains that show this banding pattern. And it's not just abnormal number of chromosomes that might be visualized in a karyotype. Sometimes a band is missing chromosome. Sometimes there's too many bands in one chromosome. And scientists are developing a library of conditions associated with abnormal banding patterns in chromosomes. Is that a scary thing? Could be, couldn't it? It's ethical, debatable, isn't it? You're going to lose your insurance, life insurance, because you hand a missing in chromosome number 8 for you, because you have some sort of increased banding pattern in chromosome number 10. Wow. You want to know how you die in the future? Oh, I don't know. Yes? No. All this extrapolated from knowing so much about how we associate specific gene populations. Actually, some individuals with Down syndrome do not have trisomy. It's still appropriately used. Sometimes extra amount of material may not show up right here, but may be translocated to the end of another chromosome, and you might miss it unless you have a trained eye. The baby will still be born Down syndrome, but they don't. That piece could be anywhere else. And just quickly, the DNA is up above here, double-stranded. Now, coils up in an elaborate fashion to form this object in all the bands. It's a question about the bands. What's going on in these bands? Well, it's tempting to think that single band, black dark band, white band, may represent one gene. But because of the way the DNA gets coiled up to see this, that blue arrow pointing at a band right there may have literally hundreds of genes in it. Cannot recognize a single gene defect in a karyotype. You have to do some biochemical studies. So there may be an increased thickness to that dark band that the arrow is pointing. Genes for sometimes too much of a good thing in that way. Was that your question? Oh, okay. So I think the question might be, if we see some abnormal banding pattern, whatever it might be, that mean that that person will absolutely develop abnormal banding pattern in this chromosome, chances of them developing this chromosome coils up. You should probably review mitosis. But what's the objective in meiosis? Development of haploid cells in gonads. And so you should review that also from general. Know something about RNA synthesis and transcription and translation. You'll discuss it in biochemistry again. And you don't have to know too much about it in here except what it is. And you'll be reading various types of RNA types, especially messenger RNA and ribosome RNA. And there's another major type of situation comparing mitosis and meiosis. First, notice that during meiosis, certainly is a common step here, the DNA duplicate. Notice that this is where chromosome number 1 here. This isn't necessarily chromosome number 6. Mitosis, chromosomes don't pair off like that. But in meiosis, number 1, in the development of sperm and eggs, chromosome number 1 and chromosome number 1 find each other, and they get their legs tangled, get their chromatids tangled up. Doesn't happen in mitosis. They get their chromatids all tangled up, and sometimes they exchange DNA from one leg to the other, from one chromatid. This is called the genetic shuffle, and it really means that just because dad had this chromosome complement and mom had the other, it doesn't mean that the children will receive chromosomes that are absolutely identical to dad's and identical to mom's. Settling of information during meiosis. These are you, again, just to show you, hey, except keep in mind paired centrioles at either end at a phase plate. We have to have a pair of centrioles here and we have to have. What are these lines, do you think, represent? And here you can see those lines. So, what do they represent? Microtubules. And what do microtubules do for a living? Move things around. Good. There's an electron microscopic image. Cell in metaphase, the chromosome. Centrioles, microtubules. Remember the name of the place where the microtubules, place where the microtubules attach? That's a jeopardy. That called? Centromere. Centromere. Now at the ends of each chromosome, more important to us than the centromere, at the end of each chromosome, there's a sequence of nucleotides that are not genes. Don't code for anything. At the end of all of our chromosomes, there's a sequence of DNA, and it has a mere part of it in its word, but it's called a telomere. And it's at the tip of each chromosome. And every time the cell divides by mitosis, the theory is that that telomere sequence becomes shorter every division. But as the cells divide, hypothesis is that when the telomere sequence is gone, because it shortens every time the cell divides, when that telomere nucleotide sequence is gone, then that cell population can never divide again, no matter how much food you get it. You can grow these cells in the laboratory, in a cell culture, and feed it all the vitamins and minerals. That cell will not divide ever again. The concept of telomere has been extrapolated to tell us that the maximal lifespan of humans is around 100 years of age, period. No one's going to live to be too aged because of telomeres, the end of chromosomes disappearing. Why are we talking about that? Not just simple academic curiosity. Cancer cells have an enzyme that generates telomeres. But if a cancer cell can regenerate the telomere ends of the chromosomes inside the cell, that means that that clone of cells, one therapeutic approach is to do something about that. Try to interfere with that enzyme that's doing that thing there. That's an important temporary issue with oncology. Okay, we are ready to move on to finish. What? Library?
Yeah.
I can't. I don't have access. I log in.
You have a flash drive?
Yeah. There's space on it. Time to take a break anyway. I'd like to read about that a little more. I don't really know, but I have to call it. It didn't respond when I put it in.
It's so weird.
Run the drive.
Unless the drive got the USB. Maybe. Do we have the pad here? Let me take out the mouse. Stay there? Okay.
I have a question for you about something that you said at the beginning of class.
Uh-huh.
The flagellum.
Yes.
You said that was a cilia, right?
Right.
And the cilia has a 9+2 formation.
Right.
Okay.
Microtubular. Right.
But that's this movement, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's a little difference in the little arms that come off the microtubule, so it's pretty much an equal movement. There's a slight difference.
So it doesn't have to do with the 9+2 arrangement of the circular or?
No, not necessarily. But the textbook kind of implies that it is. That if a 9+0 microtubule is present, well, most of the time it's immodal. But some of them actually are able to do this and they're
blocked. Okay, then I totally understand. It's nothing to do with the arrangement then, except for whether it can move or not, basically.
Right.
But,
hold on a second.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't recognized as a flash drive.
Oh.
So we unplugged the mouse and then that one. No, this one.
No, this one won't recognize the LCD. Brian brought this one.
It didn't. It didn't. Yeah, we just unplugged the mouse and then it worked.
Well, it doesn't recognize the top flash drive.
Oh, maybe it could be on the top USB. Maybe the top USB connection.
Or the top.
So it switched them.
Okay.
So, yeah, thanks.
So, all 9+2 are all cilia. They're all, no matter
what. 9+2 are all cilia.
All cilia classification, even though they might have anything like that.
Right.
Is there any way to tell what the movement is based on the 9+2?
No.
Okay.
Not that we know of yet. In fact, there's information about the fact that 9+0 still can be found in cilia that have some movement is kind of revolutionary, and exactly how these little arms slide up and down the tubule is revolutionary is new information as well.
We're still trying to
figure out how the various different cilia can move differently based upon the microtubule.
Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah,
they're so picky sometimes.
Okay, let's get going again. We lost a little bit of time, and I hope you had a chance to pee and get a drink. But we need to get started here because we lost some time. And we're under the gun for time anyway. I want to finish up with epithelium here. We've got a lot to do, and I want to try to do as much as I can to prepare you for laboratory on Thursday or Friday, depending upon which day you have it. We left off last time talking about simple epithelium, and you already have had a chance to look in lab at simple epithelium, simple squamous, cuboidal, simple columnar, and this very fancy one here called pseudostratified, which is classified as simple because all cells touch basement membrane. This nucleus in this cell right up at the top here, this nucleus here is inside of a cell, and the plasma lemma of that cell touches the basement membrane. This nucleus down here, little tiny cell, probably a stem cell, meaning it can divide. Being it can divide, it is also touching the cell membrane. I mean the basal lamina. So therefore, it's a simple epithelium. Take note of the goblet cell. And if you haven't seen them yet in lab, you will this week. And it's producing mucus for the trachea and bronchioles. And then we saw this picture here where the goblet cell is shown here, and it's mucus, although we see a drop of mucus there. It's all been washed out by the preparation, but the surface here and making those cilia, you might say, sticky. Take the particles. And the cilia have a power stroke in one direction only. Now, what we didn't get to is stratified epithelium. First question might be, what are the advantages of stacking the cells on top of one another? When the cells become stacked, what advantage does that provide? Yeah, increased thickness, increased protection. Or another way of saying it is the outside world now is farther from our sacred ground. The more cells you stack up, the greater the protection. That's like putting on several layers of clothes. undershirt, an outer shirt, you put on a sweat suit, you put on a jacket, and you're ready to go to the mountain. Better protection. Disadvantage is that the outside world is farther from the tissue space. Well, it's the same reason. The reason for the advantage is also the reason for the disadvantage. So, greater protection means that the bad things in our external environment are farther from our tissue space. But what does it also mean? It means the good things are farther from our bloodstream, not likely to be as much exchanged. So that's going to help you make predictions as you look at an organ. If you know the general function of the organ, you can predict what kind of epithelium would be there. For example, in the lung, we want oxygen to get in the bloodstream pronto. We want to get rid of that carbon dioxide as fast as we can. It would be stupid to put a stratified epithelium there, because now the blood and the air are far apart because of these layer of clothes in between. So you see that if you know the function of the organ or the tissue, you'll be able to predict what type of epithelium is found there. So let's look at some. The only two types that you'll really be expected to recognize in the lab is stratified squamous and transitional epithelium. Thing is that stratified squamous comes in forms. There's a form that has a lot of keratin in the form of intermediate filaments. That's our epidermis. And there are some examples of non-keratinized, meaning that there's a general deficiency of this protective hard surface. And a good example there is the esophagus. We don't want a dry, ornified esophagus. We want a smooth, moist esophagus. No hard surface on it. They're missing there. And there are other locations, too, where we have stratified squamous, like on the female cervix and the vagina. Perfect examples as well. It's moist, not dry and hard. Stratified cuboidal is found in ducts of glands, and we just don't have time to talk about it because we're not going to see it in lab anyway. Transitional epithelium is, however, different. We have to talk about this one. No, the keratinized is hard. Keratin means hard. Yeah, you're right. So it's easy to get those reversed. Keratinized does mean that there's an extra protection because of a hardened layer on the surface of the cell, on the free surface. Transitional epithelium has a funky name that is not consistent with our model. Our model is it's either simple or stratified. Our model is it's either squamous, cuboidal, or columnar. This name does not use that scheme. It's called transitional epithelium, but it's stratified, and it's found in the bladder and in parts of the kidney. Its special features are, as we'll see in a second, special features are it can be thick sometimes and thin other times. That means that all the cells in that epithelium have to be able to remodel. They have to be able to kind of float over one another to change from thick to thin. And I'll ask you to think about that in lab. Look at the epithelium in the bladder. If the bladder is empty, it may be a particular diameter. Bladder's full, it might be of greater diameter. But epithelium is the same. How do I line that tiny balloon? Same epithelium that lines the big balloon. Make any sense? Well, that epithelium has to remodel. And when the bladder is empty, that epithelium lining that balloon, as the bladder stretches and it fills with urine, it stretches that epithelial lining. And when you look directly at it, it'll make a little more sense. You? Now I get, okay, yes. This inside of the stomach, has the mucosa thrown into folds like an accordion. And so the epithelial cells are simple columnar. But the wall of the organ can expand by these folded mucus folds flattening out. The epithelium doesn't flatten out, but something else does. And we'll see that when we get to that part. Yeah, when some organ like the stomach expands, it's not that the epithelium has to remodel, but that the folds of the mucosa, and we don't know what mucosa is yet, and so hold off a little bit on that. So, what do you think term stratified squamous pie, stratified columnar, with idea of banding? One we need to know anything about. What are the differences there? Stratified squamous, stratified cuboidal, stratified... How are we using the terms? Several possibilities. One is that we have a bunch of squamous cells that are all stratified. Stratified cuboidal, that every cell is cuboidal, and they're stacked on top of one another. That makes sense, doesn't it? Any other possibilities? Aim for the cell, let's say stratified squamous, cuboidal cells, you have columnar cells, could have any kind of cell in it, stratified squamous could have any shape cell, but what is absolutely required, cell on the outside surface is flat. Tell me what the shape of the cell is on the outside surface of stratified cuboidal. Stratified columnar, the outside cell is columnar. It doesn't make any difference what the other cells are. Outside cell, the surface cell, is identified by name. Squamous, stratified cuboidal, and so forth. So in stratified squamous, the cells on the surface are squamous. And the cells other places have different shapes. Sometimes they're cuboidal, sometimes they're columnar, sometimes they're any kind of shape. But on the surface, that's the same on my skin here. I can scrape off in my fingernail here some of those squamous cells. It will die in them because it's keratinized. We'll talk about that in a second. This does not show, this actually is non-keratinized. And the reason I know that is because I can see nuclei in those squamous cells. If it were keratinized from my skin, there'd be no nuclei there. Instead, the cell would be filled with keratin. So the esophagus, vagina, they all have that, vocal cords, they all have that particular structure where the squamous cells at the surface contain nuclei and minimal amounts of keratin. Bladder over here, and you'll have no problem. I don't think you'll have any problem identifying transitional epithelium on a midterm exam. And what do you see when you compare the two here? When you compare stratified squamous with what you see is what you get. But tell me what the difference is. Big domes. I see the King Dome, the Tacoma Dome, the Metrodome, the Superdome. I see a huge cell, bigger than every cell in that gigantic cell, sometimes called pillow cell. These can only be seen when the bladder's empty. Bladder was full. That bladder was full and distended. That epithelium would retract down. The cells would roll over the top of one another, so to speak, and the epithelial thickness would be that thick. The epithelium thickness in the drawing. Well, from there to there. Bladder's distended with urine, that epithelium squishes down and gets very flat, and that allows more cells to become pillow cells, dome cells, big fat. Well, I like the way that Juan Pierre did this because he's asking you a picture like this to make a distinction. What distinction could you make between pseudo-stratified epithelium and stratified? What's the difference between pseudo-stratified and stratified squamous or transitional? And exactly what you would expect to see when you can't see that, able to see that. That's a good distinction. Let's go back to that. So that said was a really good said was that all cells touch the base of the membrane. I can't see that. Why is it that you can't see that? Why does that look stratified? Why does it look like the nuclei above are in cells that are packed on top of the cells below? It's not true. It's false. It's pseudo. Why can't you tell that they're not all touching the base of the membrane? Because you cannot see the plasma membrane. You can't see the perimeter of the cell. You don't know where one cell starts and the other one stops. So if you look for that, you'll be tearing your hair out. Your plasma membrane is too thin to see. You can't see that. So you'll have to just study these. But that's, there you go. Importance, the thing that you need to take with you to the lab is that stratified squamous and transitional epithelium never, ever has goblet cells. So if you think you're looking at a stratified epithelium and you see goblet cells, and if you see cilia, I may have hairs on my skin, but I have no cilia. I'm stratified squamous cilia there. So those are essential things to look for in lab to verify what you are looking at. No goblet cells, no cilia, no microvilli in stratified squamous. This, there's esophagus, and here's the free surface here, the free surface out in the world. Here's the base of the membrane zone. There. Here's our epidermis and our skin, and now we have keratin. Hard, crusty keratin on the surface, so it's a keratinized stratified. And the basement membrane is down here. Base membrane. Notice the cells are attached to the basement membrane. These cells up here are not attached. Are attached to one another, but they're not attached to the basement membrane. Notice the cells on the base here are very uniform. And what does this suggest? Because the author suggesting that is a major characteristics of the cells that touch the base allowed by other stuff. Cells that touch the base. What's happening? That prophase, anaphase, metaphase, chromosome. That's mitosis. If you are a cell up above, or up here. Any place above the basement membrane, you have left the cell cycle permanently, never to return. You are a post-mitotic cell, not ever divide. Cells that are allowed to have children, all, again, only of academic interest, because in cervical dysplasia, are men cervix, and the stratified squamous hiding above the basement membrane. That makes the hair cells that only are allowed to divide are the ones on the basal lamina. If the cells are dividing above that level, that female has cervical dysplasia. That's an important thing to introduce, I think, now. These cells on the basal lamina are pretty uniform, and they are able to, they are passing through this. And let's say that this couple right here, that two cells right there were derived from the same cell in the cell cycle. One stays home to have kids, and one goes off and becomes a product. And which one is the one that will stay home, barefoot, and pregnant? Which one? The bottom one or the top one?
Bottom one.
The other one is severed its connection to home and family. Actually, these are cousins over here. They're among family. There's transitional epithelium. Look at the cells on the surface, how big those dome cells are. Halo-y, villous. How do we know this is transitional epithelium other than it says so? Because those gigantic cells. Asterisk. What's CT stand for? Connective tissue.
Oh, yeah, that's the next one. Bothered me is why don't they call it train?
You have other stratified cuboidal. That looks like cuboidal to me.
Bothered me as a student. Those look like cubes up there, big cubes.
And many years ago, this was called stratified cuboidal. We just dropped that term.
Find a goblet cell in the bladder. Ever. Yes, they transform.
This newborn cell down here is a little baby, you know, it goes goo goo gaga down here. And it occurs through teenage, or adolescence and teenage, and it gets out here, and now the cell is my age. Look how it's transformed. Not small cell. Did I use a different color? A light blue? What color would you like? Red, okay. I just heard a seminar that you never use red. How about yellow? Should we use yellow? But this one, that shows. I had a seminar, I never use red in a PowerPoint presentation. Okay, this looks black, doesn't it? Red here. All right, so we got away from this scheme now, and this scheme is what you're focusing on in lab. Simple versus Bob's. Like that funky guy, Star Wars, Jabba the Hutt. Jabba the Hutt cells, right. Okay, let's go. Let's move on then and talk about why epithelial cells hang out together.
Glowing squares. They're hanging out together. They're sticking to one another. Not in the same way that our epithelial cells do.
In laboratory, you could disassemble these epithelial. You could do some things to shake them all apart and take maybe a couple cells out of there.
out of this mass and put them in a petri dish, and as they divide, we all stick together because they're not social. They're not antisocial like cancer cells are. Very social. And why do they stick together? How much interstitial space is found? How much extracellular space found between the thousands, hundreds of pairs? Very little. How much extracellular space is found in connective tissue? Most of it is. Majority of it is, and you got a few cells. Too much interstitial space here. And if you grow the cells in a petri dish, they stick together and they're having a good time. How do they stick together? Several ways. One would be that cells that are opposed to one another side by side may, in certain situations, develop folds where the other cell also folds, and this produces interlocking connections. Lateral interdigitation, very common in the kidney tubule cells, where the cell plasma membranes of adjacent cells kind of interlock together. However, most of the more secure connections are called cell junctions, even though I guess you could call out a cell junction, nobody does. More secure forms, various levels of security, various levels of connection. The glycocalyx itself, that sugar coat, we think, in a sense, provides some sort of adhesiveness between cells. And the epithelial cells have a lot of these little antlers sticking out that you saw in the previous slide, sugar coating. And then, as we progress from there to more and more secure connections, we go down this list here. We have some junctions that are ring junctions, which is equivalent to calling ring junctions. One, I guess we're not going to deal with one. We will encounter it in some illustrations that are coming up here. But the desmosome, macular adherence, very, very common cell junction, helps to connect stratified squamous epithelial. Cells over there have a lot of these little button-like connections. Macula means button. And this part of my shirt, connected by a desmosome attachment, cells like a spot well. I can't help myself. I have to fall back to the automobile. Spot well, a little tiny spot or button-like well between two parts, back to the pap smear of the mother. And so that's a very common type of connection. Zonula occludens, it's called. Zonula occludens, O-C-C-L-U-D-E-N, is probably the most secure of all connections between cells. So if we have two cells that have a zonula occludens, that suggests, or should suggest to you, there ain't no way anything is going to get down between those two cells, because that zonula occludens runs all the way around the cell like my belt. Zonula means belt. Macula means button. Macula button. Zonula belt. And I'll show you a picture of that here. Make it more living to you. Third type. Talk about adhering, talk about occluding, and the third type called gap junction. They have minimal shearing value to it, connecting value. C is sometimes called a communicating junction. And so epithelial cells and muscle cells, not just epithelium, but other cells that are in close contact that have to talk to one another, have to give information to one another. I'm contracting now, you can too. I'm going to shorten now. You might as well. Yeah, these are little communicating structures that communicate by the transmission of tiny molecules or ions through some holes called gap junctions. So the question is there, what's the structure, what's the function? Get it here. Before we look at the specifics of the desmosome and the specifics of the zonula occludens or tight junctions, let's look at what we have available to us. And again, as a concept, there's too many details here. The concept is here's a plasma membrane right there. One cell, the other cell number. Here's a plasma membrane of another epithelial cell.
layer. And the cell membrane or plasma membrane of each of these cells has some fancy proteins that we looked at before. Some membrane proteins that act as adhesion molecules. Here's a variety of various categories which are beyond what we need. Mentioned this here called cadherins. Plenty of evidence right now that cancer cells being antisocial don't want to associate with their sisters. They want to go off and get into the bloodstream and go to the brain and kill a person. So they're not very epithelial-like anymore. And one of the mutations that allows them to do this is a conventional type of mutation occurring in cancer where these molecules cannot be made, cancer cells. Therefore, like cells. Anyway, the point here is we have a number of possibilities, molecules, allow for the connections that we're going to see. A long time ago, in small intestine and in large intestine both, recognized that plasma membranes from one cell, plasma membranes from another cell, come very close to one another. Then it was noticed that some modifications occurred because of the presence of these molecules here. Modifications occurred that secured the epithelial cells together and allowed them to continuously touch. Here's one of the important ones for us for now. And we have skin diseases where the desmosomes are attacked by our immune system. Desmosomes is being born, it attacks the desmosome, and the skin of these people stuff off. The epithelial cells of the epidermis can no longer attach to one another. Desmosomes are gone, the skin slough off, they get infections, and oftentimes fatal disease. Keep the desmosome under your hat. I love this picture from Ross, and spend some time looking at it because it gives you a real good appreciation of what it means to be a macula and what it means to be a student. Let's look at this carefully. Here's some epithelial cells, let's say in the intestine, and the pukey drawn these lamina, but I'll ignore that fact because everything else is pretty good here. So we have three cellular compartments. L1, and you can see it's in, I like it. Get the picture so far. These little cubicles, little rooms there, three-dimensionally. There's some microvilli projecting up the surface area. Might as well talk about that now, that if we're in the small intestine, and the columnar epithelium look like this, that means the food out here, food particles that are brought into the bloodstream down here, can be absorbed depending upon the extent of the surface area that the food comes in contact with. Does that make sense?
The degree and the ability and the amount of food we can absorb depends upon the surface area that the food can make contact with.
So throughout evolution and the act of God or whatever you believe, the surface of that cell, plasma membrane, thrown into fold. Now the food's out here. Now how much surface area does the food come in contact with? Enhance absorption.
A lot, doesn't it? We've increased the surface area of the plasma membrane to enhance absorption of food. What might happen in celiac disease? Anybody?
Yeah, there's multiple things that happen in celiac disease. Multiple things, and here's one of them. The cells transform that. These are, by the way, called microvilli. And why are they not cilia, do you think?
Why would they not be cilia?
They're microvilli. And so this is one of the many things that happens in celiac disease. How good is the person in absorbing food now?
Increased, isn't it? Because the surface area is decreased.
Well, that was kind of a timeout story here because there's a nice picture of microvilli up there and the actin filament microvilli. No, there's other kinds of diseases, other kinds of food allergies and autoimmune conditions.
Or the desmosomes, wires,
tiny spot, a button. Here's another desmosome down here, and there's a desmosome down here.
Little spot wells between cells.
How about the tight junction? I'm not going to get into the details of it, but the tight junction run away. For only desmosomes, no problem. We just get to avoid the desmosome. Here in I avoid the desmosomes. I can go in here. I can be a bacterium and get in here. But I can't down here. Tight junction, the belt, it goes all the way around. And so that's a really great illustration of that. One other thing, too, and that is the actin filament, microtubule, playing with a pair of cytoskeleton. Actin joins with a secure base. And that cytoskeleton is called the terminal web. And that terminal web, therefore, is a cytoskeletal entity that secures the microtubules to the top of the cell. Would microvilli in the small intestine ever be on the bottom of the cell? Or it's up near the top. Attic of a desmosome, plasma membrane from one cell number, plasma membrane of neighbor. I'm in Paulsbo, and there's houses that are about that close together in Paulsbo. And if you knew New York City and the row houses, you can't really squeak between them. This desmosome is a spot weld, and you can't go through the desmosome, but you round it, can't you? Round the desmosome. In the middle of it. Fancy stuff. These filaments here are made of keratin. Keratin filaments. And your textbook talks about all of the chemistry of this, and the reason is because we have autoimmune diseases that attack these structures, and it's beyond us for now. I want you to know that a good bit of the structure of a desmosome are these fibers called keratinoglucans. I don't care about the details of that, just that there's a specific anatomy associated with it. The end result's what's important. Here's the gap junction. Here's the plasma bilipid, the phospholipid bilayer of cell number one, and there's the phospholipid bilayer of cell number two. And right in this circular area here is where those two plasma membranes come close together, and a modification occurs in the phospholipid bilayer that allows for the formation of little portholes and the passage of tiny molecules either this way or those little cylinders. Cylinder of one plasma membrane, the cylinder of the other plasma membrane, and they superimpose on one another and allow for this. Okay. We haven't finished with epithelium. There's a couple of things to do, but we have to go for a few minutes. Connective tissue. If you look at the syllabus, you'll see we'll come back and finish epithelium, and it won't take very long, half an hour. We're going to move our discussion now out of the epithelium down into the tissue space. We're looking at a new tissue now. Probably the most complicated of all four tissues is connective tissue, because there's so many different functions, many different structural variations, and it can be a little intimidating and challenging to get a good handle on the structure and function of connective tissue. So we have to talk about some things in general here. The definition of connective tissue depends upon who you're listening to. For me, connective tissue would be the cells and extracellular material that occupy the tissue space. In other words, the epithelium, tissue space is found between the surface epithelium and the bloodstream realm in there. Connective tissue is found in there. It could also be defined as that tissue that provides connection of different things in the tissue space. And is responsible for making everyone's stomach look the same. But his skeletal muscle maintains form and structure. Organs has multiple functions, but general function would be to maintain the shape and structure of organs. Composition is either cells, where they look very far apart, not touching one another like an epithelium. Well, they can touch, though. And then connective tissue is exemplified by all kinds of a variety of non-living stuff, non-living material. Cells are classified as living materials because they can make ATP, fire. Extracellular materials, of which is the bulk of connective tissue, non-living material. It is produced by the cell. And Much of this extracellular material is in the form of proteinaceous fibers, very fancy protein fibers, and some extracellular material. Extracellular material, I think we call it amorphous term because there's plenty of structure to it. It's just that the histologist can't see it. It has white so fibers and ground cells, and there it is. Fibers you can see, cells there. Cells generally are blobby, that word means. Blobby, round, spherical, they're cells. The fibers are threads, and the common two fibers are shown here. Collagen fibers, big, fat, hefty fibers. Plastic fibers, thin ones. Plastic fibers, very thin ones. Collagen fibers,
threads.
Collagen fibers. And in the H&E stain, there'll be hefty pink staining by eosin there. Right. That's the nature of connective tissue, is fibers, and the ground substance appears empty. Plenty of structure there. There's another view of it. Collagen fibers, the big hefty ones, the elastic fibers are actually branched. The elastic fibers are branched, and you'll have a specimen in the lab where you can look at if you wish. Elastic fibers are branching, fibers are not branching. Which one of them is the strongest? Which one of them is closest to a spider web strength? Which one of them is closest to fire and strength? Collagen, which is elastic fiber. Here are some of the cells, the fibroblasts. These are the primary cells that make the fibers and the ground substance. Make the fibers and the ground substance. And they're having, how do you know that? Well, I'm a fibroblast. And am I having a good time doing this? I'm making these fibers, and I really love my job. Fibroblast. Now, the next series of slides in 5 minutes will be an example of what you might get to in lab. Hopefully, that should be your goal. If you don't get there, don't feel sad about it. Plenty of time. And so let's look at how these fibroblasts and how this collagen and elastic fibers and whatnot, how they get together to form connective tissue in different regions on our skin. How about the connective tissue in the wall of the stomach? How does it work in tendon and ligaments? So you're going to be looking at tendon in the lab and maybe ligament. You're going to look at these accumulations of fibroblasts. Notice they don't look like they're touching. If anybody saw this on an exam, I will tear my hair out. Why is it not? If aren't touching? They're not touching. They're far apart with all this extracellular material, big E here. All this extracellular stuff keeping. All right. Let's move to fibers. There we go. So in laboratory, you're going to be looking at different forms of connective tissue. Your textbook is getting away from this because there are so many examples of connective tissue that are intermediate, transitional stuff to what we're going to talk about. But it's still a useful thing. But we have two general categories of connective tissue proper. We have loose connective tissue and dense connective tissue. Two major categories. It's either delicate and loose, or it's dense and tough. And those terms, loose and dense, actually refer concentration and the strength and the density of collagen fibers. Dense connective tissue has hugely strong, thick, fat collagen fibers. Loose, much less. Embryonic connective tissue, when it first forms, called mesenchyme, it's not very strong. And you can imagine that fetus, that embryo, is very delicate. And this early embryonic connective tissue is called mesenchyme, and we still have areas of mesenchyme left in us. However, most of the loose connective tissue in our body, we're going to call areolar. I don't know what that word means. I keep forgetting. Areolar connective tissue is found in every organ, and it's very gentle, and very flaky, and fragile looking, and loose. And so You're not going to see mesenchyme much in the human, except maybe in the umbilical cord, and we lost that a long time ago. This loose stuff that helps hold the epithelium in place. Components are cells and fiber. Adipose tissue is also called loose because there's not much collagen. A lot of cells, but just a little bit of collagen. That's fat, which comes in what is also yellow in the cadaver. So we'll call it yellow fat. White fat, microscopically, is white. Grossly, it looks yellow. And then reticular tissue, a very special kind of loose connective tissue. And we're going to, here's a little scheme that categories we are focusing our attention here. Next week, we'll go here. Have what's called connective tissue proper, or I like to call it soft connective tissue. And next week, we'll talk about the hard connective tissue, cartilage. There's loose connective tissue as compared to embryonic mesenchyme. Mesenchyme has very little fibers. The connective tissue, the skin of a developing fetus during pregnancy, being a lot of different organs that are beginning to develop. And here's the adult, and we'll call it a realer, as the previous slide. A realer connective tissue or loose connective tissue in the adult. Notice the fibers don't stand out very well. And it looks like there's a lot of cells. A realer connective tissue looks really cellular. Fibers are very skimpy. Let's go to dense. And here's a tendon. What makes us dense? Makes us dense are these heavy, thick, pink collagen fibers. All this pink in here is dense collagen. Everything you see is collagen except for the fibroblasts. They're indicated by the arrows. So collagen fibers, this pink, heavy-duty, stainless steel wired in tendon, are all lined up parallel to make them live in between. So a collagen fiber or fibers in tendon are all lined up parallel to one another. I'm leaving some space here, even though it doesn't show it up there. And then in between the fibers are the cells that make the collagen. And those are the fibroblasts. Why do you think these wires are running parallel to one another in a tendon? Tendon inserts the, why would you expect these wires, the collagen fibers, to transmit the force in a particular direction? How are we going to put the collagen fibers in your skin? Fibers in the skin are, oh, they're going to be running in every conceivable direction. Provides strength in various directions. Here's tendon. Collagen fibers and the fibroblasts are all kind of parallel. Here's dermis of the skin. These pink beauties here don't run parallel. They're running in all different directions, even though you only have a two-dimensional model. And here, some of them are cut in cross-section. Some fibers are running obliquely. Some fibers are running longitudinally. You may not get that appreciation very well in a two-dimensional image, but trust me, those collagen fibers over on the right are not running parallel to one another, but want to transmit the force applied to the skin in various directions. Compare the dense with the loose. See, what is an obvious difference between the dense connective tissue on the right and the loose connective tissue on the left? Collagen fibers, big, hefty Arnold Schwarzenegger on the left, are within, and lots of cells show up in loose connective tissue. Okay, now that took a couple more minutes than I thought, but you should be ready for lab to begin thinking about these different types of connective tissue. Some of you don't won't get to it this week. Don't worry about it if you don't.